Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Katie Finneran. Peter reviews Lovesick at Theater Works in Hartford. Damn Yankees, a good speed. Plus, we talk about a bunch of the week's news. So please stay tuned.
Pardon me, is everybody there? Because if everybody's there, I want to thank you all for coming to the wedding. I'd appreciate your going even more. I mean, you must have lots of better things to do, and not a word of it to Paul. Remember, Paul, you know the man I'm going to marry, but I'm not, because I wouldn't ruin anyone as wonderful as he is. But I thank you all for the gifts and the flowers. Thank you all. Now it's back to the showers. Don't tell Paul, but I'm not getting married today.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, May 25th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and this morning on the broadcast we have Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Stripper, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good day.
Hello. Michael is actually out with some family today, so we will see him back next week. I was able to speak with two-time Tony Award-winning Broadway and TV star Katie Finneran about her debut at 54 Below, It Might Be You, which is coming up on May 28th to the 31st. So Katie, welcome. I hear that you have a great story about another Broadway and film star. Why don't you start us off with that?
Tom Hanks, everybody knows he's a great guy, but I did a movie with him like 20 years ago. You've Got Mail. I'm not sure how many years ago.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But that was like my first big budget film, and I had a tiny little role in it, and I had to walk down this big long pier and then have a line with Tom Hanks, and I kept missing my mark. I would walk down this big long pier and then I would just overstep or look at my mark, and it was horrible. And there were 60 crew members like waiting for me, and Nora Ephron kept saying, we can see you looking at your mark. And Tom Hanks is there waiting for me. It was awful. And he stopped everyone and he goes, Hey, let's get her a sandbag. Let's show her how to hit her mark. And he took the time to show me how to hit my mark like a pro. And he was just friendly and glorious and really broke the ice for me.
Oh, that's such a wonderful story.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about this all the time about how the nicest people in the business seem to rise to the top. And that must say something for you because, as I mentioned, you know, you have so many great credits and stuff that's going on there. And you're able to be very progressive. You're about to head off to do, is it a Netflix series?
It is. It's the next Netflix show written by Glenn Kessler, Todd Kessler, and Daniel Zellman, who did Damages with Glenn Close. And it's starring Sam Shepard and Sissy Spacek and Norbert Leo Butz and Kyle Chandler and these great actors. And it's like a drama. It's like a big family drama.
And then right after you go off and shoot for a few weeks, you come back and you have your show at 54 Below.
Which I'm terrified about, by the way. They asked me, I've done a bunch of musicals on and off in the last, 25 years. And I've been asked before to do like 20 minutes. You have 20 minutes? Come here, do 20 minutes. That means like, a group of songs that you want to perform. And it always intimidated me. And finally, 54 Below asked me to do, a show, and I finally said yes because I thought, why am I so terrified of this? I think it's because I'm talking about myself and I'm talking about myself and just singing songs for an hour, and that really intimidated me. But it's been a wonderful process. It's been very creative, and I get to tell some really funny, very personal stories.
Who's your musical director?
Steve Marzullo, who's incredible. He's just an incredible guy. He's worked on a ton of Broadway shows and works a lot with Andrea McArdle, and he plays for everyone that's ever been famous he plays for. So he's terrific.
So are you going to have any inside info from, say, the Michael J. Fox show?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
And
I can give you any dirt on Michael J. Fox because I'm in love with him, and nothing has changed. Anything that you think about him is true. He's the greatest guy that ever lived. Really, a wonderful man, and I have a huge crush on him. And I just loved playing with him.
So I want to ask you something that you probably don't get asked about a lot, but my favorite year is really one of my favorite shows ever.
Oh, isn't it the best? 20 million people, no, 20 million plus.
Just a great opening number. Just 5 minutes to go, you know? So tell me about that. Were you involved with that from the very beginning?
I was. I did a workshop, actually, with Victor Garber originally, and then it was Tim Curry, and I sort of did all the I think there was one workshop before, and then we did the show. And it was fantastic. I loved it. Andrea Martin was amazing, and Stephen Lynn's music and lyrics were, you know, phenomenal. It was a wonderful first big musical to do on Broadway. I had a part playing Tim Curry's daughter, and then I also covered the lead girl with Evan Pappas, and I got to go on one night in Terrified, but I got to do that great number with Andrea Martin.
With the duck?
Yes, it's a great number. In fact, I wanted to do that in my act, but I you know, obviously Andrea Martin's very busy, and who else is going to play that part? No one. So, but it was a great time in my life. I loved that show.
So, you have songs ranging from Stephen Sondheim to Ingrid Michaelson. Ingrid Michaelson is that indie rocker from, I think she's from Brooklyn or Staten Island or something.
Yeah, she sings some really beautiful, simple songs.
Really.
What did you say?
I was just going to say exactly what you said. Simple, beautiful songs. I think that she had the big hit on Grey's Anatomy, didn't she?
I can't remember. I just want to be alone or something.
Yeah.
Can't remember.
But that's...
she writes these beautiful songs with, some of them have some strange melodies, but they always have a sense of humor about them. And her lyrics are very specific and simple, and you can hear her lyrics. I can't stand it when someone's worked really hard on a song and you can't understand what they're singing. It makes me crazy. But I think she's just, I feel like delighted when I hear her stuff. I feel moved and delighted. And I chose one of her songs to sing.
So you're not going to be doing any Linkin Park?
No Linkin Park.
No Linkin Park.
I would, you know, if they invited me to sit in with them, I would be happy to have that experience anytime they would like to.
So the title of the show, it might be you, A Funny Lady's Search for Home. So tell us what's behind the title there.
I've always felt that my true home was in the theater. Whenever I do a new job, those people become my family. And I grew up with wonderful parents and a brother, but I really felt like I was at home when I was doing a show or in some sort of creative environment. And my goal in life was really to have my own family and merge those two homes in a way. And so it was about really finding a person that could share those same loves that I had, and having children and sort of mixing it all together.
Well, that's wonderful. You know, it's, it says here that your director for the show is Andrea Burns, who is a funny person, isn't she?
Andrea Burns and I have been friends since we were 15, best friends in high school. We both moved here when we were 19. And she knows me better than anybody. And she is such a great director. She's incredibly intelligent. And from the time we were young, I knew that she was a great director. And when this came about, it's so many years later, she knows all my tricks. She knows all my skills. She knows all my insecurities. There was nobody better to direct the show than Andrea.
All right. So I mentioned that you've got a long list of Broadway shows. So give me maybe one word or maybe one sentence on each as I rattle them off. On Borrowed Time.
On Borrowed Time, my first Broadway show, George C. Scott. I was hired to play an understudy. Are you saying one word or one sentence? I can't do that. Okay. George C. Scott. It was an incredible masterclass in how the greats do it.
All right. Two Shakespearean actors.
Oh, it was heaven. It was Victor Garber and Brian Bedford, Jelko Ivanek. So many incredible. Hope Davis, Judy Kuhn, so many great actors. And I got to watch them every day.
My favorite year we just talked about. So In the Summer House?
In the Summer House was Joanne Acolytis. And I was an understudy. And I got to watch the way she worked in a very different sort of way than I had ever experienced. Also a great learning experience.
And the heiress?
The best. Cherry Jones is the best. I mean, you can't get any better than Cherry Jones. I think it's, if I could emulate a bit of what Cherry Jones puts out in the universe, I'm doing well.
And Proposals?
Proposals. Neil Simon and I became friends during Proposals, and I learned a lot from him. just about comedy, about life, about the business. Manny Eisenberg also became a good friend of mine out of that show, who was the producer, one of my favorite producers ever.
And Cabaret, which is come back.
The most rock star I've ever felt in my life and will ever feel again doing that show.
You played Sally Bowles as a replacement.
It was so much fun. It was such a whirlwind. You know, I learned it in a couple of weeks and then got thrown in. And there I was, you know, center stage singing.
Who's your MC?
Matt McGrath.
Great.
Michael Hayden was my Cliff. It was such a great show. It was so beautifully done.
Iceman Cometh?
Wow. Intense. I was so glad to do O'Neill and to do it with Kevin Spacey. And he was really galvanizing. And it was fun to do it at the height of his excitement surrounding American Beauty. And the actors, Michael Emerson, Paul Giamatti, Tim Piggott Smith, to watch them, it was like watching people do an aria every night. It was really a privilege.
Noises off.
Oh, the best. I was exhausted, but it was so much fun. So don't get hit by a 100-pound steel door in the forehead during the show.
Oh.
And I just kept going, but I had this huge egg on the top of my forehead. It was a blast. And that show was so special because we were doing it, we were in rehearsals. The second day of rehearsal was 9/11. And so it was a wonderful gift to give to an audience sort of an unambiguous comedy where it's physical comedy and it's just uncomplicated and, you know, meticulously structured, perfectly structured play, but uncomplicated in its humor. So people could really let go and have a great time when they came to see the show.
So you might have to help me with this next one. I always get it wrong. Teresa Rabeck's
Mauritius.
Mauritius.
Yes. Mauritius. Mauritius.
Mauritius.
Do you know that I learned about philatelists when I did play Mauritius? That's the first play that I read, first modern Broadway play that I read that I could not put down. It was like reading a great mystery. It was like reading a great thriller. I loved reading that play. I said yes immediately. They offered it to me and I said, yes, when do I get on a plane? Mm-hmm. I was in Los Angeles at the time and I was like, yes, I'll come back and I want to do this play. It was so much fun. It was a great Bobby Cannavale, Alison Pill, F. Murray Abraham, Dylan Baker. What a cast. And we had a great time. And it was the first time I ever played an unlikable, like, boo-worthy character. And it was really good for me. The first time I heard the audience boo at me. Wait, what? I am totally misunderstood here. Why do you hate me? I know. You understand my side of the story. It was great. It was really great for me.
Promises, promises.
Oh, you know, that was just... so unexpected and such a heavenly experience. I just loved it. I met my husband a couple of years before, and during Promises, Promises is when we got married and became pregnant. So really quite early in the run, I became pregnant during that show. So I was exhausted. I got to sleep during the first act and perform in the second act. And they kept having to add more stretchy black lace to my outfit. And reluctantly, I left when I was like 8 months pregnant because it's just not part of the story anymore. So, but I loved that show. I loved doing it. I loved working with Sean Hayes and Neil Simon, and it was a beautiful time.
Well, I don't know. Could you have done a pregnant Hannigan?
You know, that would have been really complicated. But I did audition for Hannigan when I was pregnant. For 8 months pregnant. So what were they thinking? I don't know.
Of course, but, you're talking about Annie.
That would have been really complicated because the baby would have wound up in the orphanage and then, you know, what would have happened there? Annie was great. And I was so happy to do it because how many times in my life will I get to do a show where little kids can come and see it and be crazy about it? They loved. I met at least 10 children after every performance. You know, friends of friends or family members who had little kids would come back after every show. And I thought, when am I going to get a chance to do this in the rest of my life, to entertain in this grand way children? It's pretty great. It was a pretty great experience.
So I see a theme running through all the your descriptions of your of the shows, and a lot of it comes back to consistently learning from others.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you've talked about how you've been able to watch from the sidelines and learn, and whether it be Tom Hanks teaching you to hit your marks, or watching the other greats on stage, or doing other things. So that's interesting. And you're from Chicago, and you ended up at Carnegie Mellon for a year. How did that happen?
I did. I went to a program when I was in 11th grade, and they had a summer program, and I auditioned for Carnegie Mellon in that summer, and they chose me to go to school there. And so I went there for a year, and I'd had wonderful training at New World School of the Arts in Miami, Florida. It was a school started by Richard Klein, who did the LaGuardia School for the Arts in New York. So it was a very intense training. And when I went to Carnegie Mellon, I realized that I had already had some of the training, and it was so expensive to go to school there. I didn't want to be terribly, terribly in debt when I graduated. And it was, you know, a hardship for me. So we kept studying Uta Hagen's book in drama class, and I thought, well, maybe I should just see if I can go study with her in New York myself. And so I auditioned for her, and I got in, and I think she taught me for like $10 a class, or $7 a class. It was the price of a movie ticket when I moved. And it was a great way to go, because she taught me everything that I know today. She was the greatest influence on my acting life.
It's so amazing that you've shown just through example that there's many different paths to learning and achieving your goals.
You know, I always say that to people who ask me, especially in acting, I always say, if you want to be a doctor, there's a couple of tests that you have to pass. Mm-hmm. You just have to take that route, and it's the same for everybody. But if you want to be an actor, you really, there's a million different paths that you can follow. What's important is being authentic and to follow what's right for you. This was absolutely, I didn't regret for one day that I didn't, you know, graduate from college, but learning for me has been always a difficult thing, and I've had to do it my own way. And, you know, there's, in today's day and age, you can learn anything that you want to in any way that you want to, at any pace, in any form. And so that's really what I have done in my life.
Well, Katie, I just want to remind everybody that your show is coming up May 28th to the 31st at 54 Below, and we'll put links on it on the show we'll put links to your show on our show page so that our listeners can take a look at it and come check out your show. Thank you so much for joining us and spending some time with us.
Thank you so much. Have a great night.
You too.
Bye.
Tall and slender like an Apollo, he goes walking by, and I have to follow him, the boy from Tacuarembola to Madelfuego, Santa Malibaza.
So, Peter, you got a chance to see Lovesick up at TheaterWorks in Hartford. So why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. John Cariani has had an amazing success with his little playlets called Almost Maine. They've been done certainly in Maine and certainly virtually, probably actually in every state of the country. And even though they had very little success off-Broadway, they didn't last there long at all. And somehow they got picked up, and somehow the word spread. And I imagine he's a reasonably wealthy man as a result from all these productions here, there, and everywhere. Well, I think he's going to be three times as wealthy as a result of Lovesick, because I think these plays are substantially funnier and pithier. I do think that we're going to see them here, there, and everywhere. They've only been done in Portland and now in Hartford, only two productions so far. But I dare say that there has not been any audience I have been in this season that has laughed harder than the one I was in on Thursday night in Hartford. My, what a good time they had. And the subject is relationships. The subject is marriage, mostly. There are many heterosexual couples. There's one gay male couple and one gay female couple. And the one with the female couple is rather poignant, because this is about a couple that has had two children. One of them has been the actual mother, and she stays at home with the kids while the other one goes out to work. And it's all about the issues of why don't you pick up for a change, says the woman who's always home. Yeah, but I go out and work. And you see the real difficulties, and you really think that this couple may not make it as a result of the strife that they're in. And the way he pulls it out that makes you have hope for them at the end is very skillful. The gay couple is more really met just recently, and now it's time for one of them to say, look, I love you. And the other one isn't quite ready for that, to the point of which he pretends he can't even hear him. What's really good about this, though, is that the term I love you, I think that each one of the plays, and there's about eight of them, the words I love you show up. There was one I didn't quite hear that, but I might have missed it. But I wouldn't be surprised if thematically he was going for that, that I loved you showed up in every play. But the thing is, sometimes it's really said through gritted teeth. Sometimes it's said in a way that doesn't convince you at all that these people do love each other anymore. One woman complains about being bored their marriage and must do something to spice up the relationship. So she pulls a gun out on her husband. She talks about people who have killed their spouses. And, you know, it's really, it brought up a point I bring up quite a bit. And that is, have you ever noticed that when a spouse is murdered, that the police always suspect the surviving spouse? Now, why is that? Why don't the police say, well, it couldn't be the spouse. They loved each other. I mean, why is that? I mean, there's something fundamentally wrong there. And these plays certainly suggest that. The boredom of marriage, the day-to-day, the taking care of the kids, just getting along, the near misses, the people, two people meet in a hardware, well, not a hardware store, a Home Depot-y type thing, and they connect a little, but they can't quite get to the point where they can really connect and stay together. And they're only one sentence away, you can tell, from starting a relationship. Another couple meets in the same Home Depot, and indeed, this couple once was married. And now one has been divorced, one has been widowed, and should they get back together again? And there's a part of them that wants to, and certainly a part of them that doesn't, because they know all the pitfalls that they had in learning about each other, and they certainly knew all the good things they had. And that's a very interesting concept, isn't it? You know, people we have known, is the devil we've known or the angel we've known better than the one we don't. So a good cast, too. People who may not be known to anybody, Pascal Armand, Bruce Reed, Chris Thorne, and Laura Woodward. I can't say that these are people that struck me as people I've seen many, many times. That said, they were all tremendously skillful in playing a number of roles, of course. And Amy Saltz, a name we do know, certainly directed them. And it was, but good law, the Titanic sound of people laughing when they were supposed to. As I say, there are some times when they're not. Was just wonderful. It really was terrific. So I do think that this one is going to be even more successful than Almost Maine. And that means a blockbuster.
So I'm looking around, and Almost Maine has gotten 70 productions around the world so far, and they're out there hawking it really, really well. So, you know, there's such a life that can be had outside of the Broadway sphere.
Oh, to say the least. And what's really wonderful is that as time has gone on, one doesn't have to have a blockbuster title to have a successful show. I mean, for example, Seussical, which bombed on Broadway. Let's face it, there's no other way to put it. Sure, it lasted 6 months, but it didn't have a good run here. Nobody was ever running for tickets like crazy. And again, I'm not coming down on the property itself. I'm only saying that this is the reality. And yet, whoa, the nation didn't care what the Broadway reputation was any more than it's cared about the off-Broadway reputation about Almost Maine. We like the script. In the case of Seussical, we like the score. We're doing it. We don't care, you know, and that's so healthy because it used to be, well, it still is. I mean, so many times you go to when I go to regional theaters around the country and see what's playing, what is it? Last year's New York hits, you know, the plays that were not necessarily musicals because musicals run longer, but last year's New York play hits are the ones that the theaters tend to do, or the off-Broadway hits. But the point is, these are the ones that have the pedigree. A few awards here, be they Tonys, be they Obies, be they Drama Desks. But the point is, they do have this badge of honor attached to them, and the artistic directors say, well, look, I mean, you know, it did so well in New York. I mean, you should like it, my subscribers. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But I really am very impressed when an artistic director will take a chance on something because he likes it or she likes it. And I think that's really terrific. So I do think we're going to hear from Lovesick. And frankly, wherever it is, I'm looking forward to seeing it again.
So I'm looking up John Cariani, the author of Lovesick and Almost Maine. And did you know he's also an actor?
Oh, yeah, he was in Fiddler and Tony
nomination. Yeah, he received a Tony nomination. I didn't realize it was the same guy. And he is, at least his Wikipedia page says he is best known as this character, Julian Beck, on Law & Order CSI.
I met him afterwards. He seemed so unassuming, so shy, a real regular guy. So, I'm surprised to hear that he has Law & Order credit of that distinction, of course. Alison Frazier used to brag she was the only person in New York who didn't get a Law & Order gig, but, you know, the rest of them do. But for him to have, you know, a character name, wow, I'm impressed. That's pretty good indeed.
So I'm looking forward to this. I really loved Almost Maine, so I'm going to have to get up to Hartford Stage and check this out, see mm-hmm. how it goes. Mm-hmm. So you stayed in the state of Connecticut. Or did you come home and go back?
What I was actually doing, I was going to a class reunion, and there's a funny story there attached too, because one of the women, my former classmates, came up to me and said, "Oh, you know, boy, you're leading the life I'd love to leave because I just love Broadway musicals. I'm just crazy about them." So I said, "Oh, what was the first one you ever saw?" And let me tell you, James, when I ask this question, if somebody says, I lose 75% interest in the person already. I mean, I want that person to have that memory, you know, ingrained, you know. And this lady was right there when she said, "Sail Away, August 1961, Colonial Theater." And you tell me that there was someone in my class who had seen a pre-Broadway tryout before I did. What a humiliation. So anyway, so yes, I saw Lovesick up on the way to the reunion, and I saw Damn Yankees at Goodspeed on the way back. Now, the thing about Damn Yankees, a few years ago I saw it in Beverly, Massachusetts. This is the rewritten version by Joe DiPietro. And what he did, and it's instead of using the Washington Senators, a team that has come and gone twice, he has said it much more significantly with the Boston Red Sox. All right. He put it in the 50s where Damn Yankees originally was. Fine. No problem. But when he did it in Beverly, the big flaw was that well, you know, in the song Heart, in that section, "A great slugger we haven't got." Well, excuse me, but in the 50s, a great slugger the Red Sox did have, and that was Ted Williams.
Yeah.
And I remember writing at the time that you can't do that. I mean, what you can do is go back to 52 when he was actually in the Korean War. He was a very patriotic guy, and he lost a lot of time as a result of the wars, where he could have really amassed bigger figures than he did. And I mean, when he retired, he was the fourth most prolific home run hitter in baseball, but he could have done much better had he not elected to serve in the armed forces. And I'm not criticizing him for that, believe me. I mean, you know, God love him for doing it. But anyway, the point is, I remember writing at the time, gee, you know, he should set it earlier, because that way a great slugger we haven't gotten. They could allude to that very quickly, that, you know, he's in the army, you know, that type of thing. Well, I'm not saying that he took my suggestion. I have a feeling other people told him this too. And as a result, he has done that. He's made that allowance. So, but you should have heard me yesterday actually scream out that people turned around because suddenly I yelled out, nine! Now, here's the thing. Ted Williams was number nine. And, you know, that's a very famous number in Boston, where I'm from. So as a result, I mean, they had a ball player wearing nine. Now, people who don't know baseball said, well, you know, what must have happened is that while he was away, they gave his number to somebody. That does not happen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the numbers are pretty sacred. And somebody of that caliber would not have his number given to someone else. In fact, you may know that in baseball, they retire numbers after a great player has finished his career. As a tribute to him, they do not give that number ever to anybody else. You know, by the way, which reminds me of a completely different story about Ernestine Jackson, the actress who, when she was working in Chock Full of Nuts, and she got the role in Raisin, and her boss said, nobody else will ever have the same number as you because they all have employee numbers. And he retired her number. They used to recycle them, but he retired her number because he was so thrilled that she had gotten a role at a Broadway show. This was actually printed in Sports Illustrated at the time. That's how I know the story. Anyway, the ignorance of Boston baseball really shamed me at that moment, that nobody on the staff of Goodspeed pointed that out. So I was very disappointed in that, and I hope that they throw a number one in front of that nine before the run ends. All right, so how's the show? very good. I will admit that I'm still rankling about the fact that there is that famous story that Babe Ruth was traded to the Yankees so that the owner of the Red Sox, Harry Frazee, could finance No, 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 Net. There was a six-year difference. I mean, today, yes, 6 years it takes to get on a Broadway musical. In those days, it was a week and a half, you know. So I think Joe should work on that, too. I know why he's doing it. You know, I mean, it's a great joke to get in. You know, hearing No, 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 Net certainly satisfies the people in the audience who have less interest in baseball, but it does happen to be inaccurate, so I'll get sticky about that one too. But the production, gee, really good, quite nice, and I was very, very impressed by Angel Rita. I will admit, full disclosure, that this was not an actress unknown to me. She attended the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, where I go twice a year to lecture. But I hadn't seen her in a while. I know that she's been doing Chicago for a long time. But here she was playing Lola, and she was really, really dazzling in the role, and the audience really took to her. David Beach, a name unknown to me, was playing the role of Mr. Applegate. Yeah, you know, and it's funny, you know, it occurred to me, you know, this is something, of course, that would only have come up since 1972. But since every scandal now has the word gate in it, you know, it's funny to hear about Applegate. I guess if there's a scandal at the Apple Computer Company, they'll call it Applegate. But we got there first, you know, when you think of it, because but anyway, if I didn't know that Reed Birney was currently in Casa Valentina, I would swear that Reed Birney was playing the role of Mr. Applegate here. This David Beach resembles him physically, facially, and certainly has the same type of mannerisms. I'm not saying he's imitating him. I'm not saying that at all, at all, at all. What I am saying, however, is that he is tremendously like him in so many ways that I really felt that's who I was seeing. So that said, he's terrific in the part. It's so interesting with the Goodspeed audience. There's no question that the Goodspeed audience is on the elderly side, and they've been going there for a long time. And I was really interested to see if they would respond to the line in Mr. Applegate's song, "Those Were the Good Old Days." If they would, there's a line where he says, "Was anybody happy?" Now, that relates to an entertainer named Ted Lewis, who used to, his signature line was, "Is everybody happy?" And I was really going to be interested to see if the Goodspeed audience would respond to that line, or I mean, Ted Lewis was a long time ago. So was it too old for this audience? That was the question that I was interested in hearing. It got quite a laugh. So there's no question that they know who Ted Lewis is at the Goodspeed Opera House. Stephen Mark Lewis, a name unknown to me, played Joe Hardy, and he had the perfect look and mannerisms and style. So he was really quite terrific in this role. And of course, I may have mentioned this. We've been doing this for a long time now, James, and I guess somewhere along the line, Damn Yankees has my favorite line in all Broadway musicals, mm-hmm. because after whatever Lola wants, where she tries to vamp him, where she tries to seduce him, after she's finished, he says, "But if it were you, I had promised to come home to, you'd want me to, wouldn't you?" And I love that line because he's just so loyal to his wife, who, by the way, is sensationally played by a woman named Ann Arvia, who giving a performance of such texture as the wife who's left behind, who has no idea what's happened to her husband, who's really hurting, who finds herself attracted to this man, and this new guy who's boarding with her, Joe Hardy, who's really Joe Boyd. And she's really good at indicating there's something about this guy that reminds me of my husband, but this is so ridiculous because he's nothing like my husband. He doesn't look like him. He's much younger, etc. But, you know, getting in that is a difficult thing to do. And I think this woman is sensational beyond belief in conveying this. And I was delighted to see her do so well in the part. So a few niggly nitpicks here. Involving structure. I will say that I wish that Joe had done something I wish George Abbott had done way back when. I mean, I still don't understand why, if a player has not had one at-bat yet, that everybody is doing this big number called Shoeless Joe from Hannibal Moe. I think that should happen later. I also think it would be much more effective for Joe Hardy after the team starts winning, start singing, "You Gotta Have Heart." You know, I wish that those structural moves have been, again, I blame George Abbott way back when. I blame George Abbott for a lot of things, but that's another story. Still, you know, that score by Adler and Ross, and again, the poignancy of knowing that this was their last score. I mean, it was just yesterday it occurred to me that the Pajama Game was Adler and Ross's first and penultimate score, because indeed they only wrote two, because Jerry Ross died so young, and Lord knows what the musical theater would have been if indeed those guys kept writing, because those guys still have the record and probably will always hold it for having two Tony-winning musicals consecutively open in 357 days, not even a year. And that's pretty amazing. So we shall not see its like again. And losing Jerry Ross was really a catastrophe, because Richard Adler could never have another hit after that. He tried a few times, but never. And these guys really had some sort of magic together. And ironically enough, it wasn't a case where the credits ever said music by Richard Adler, lyrics by Jerry Ross, or vice versa. It was music and lyrics by these guys, you know, stayed in the same room together. And no, that word shouldn't be that. It should be that. Oh, what if you went to a D7 there? You know, that type of thing. They really worked. There was a real collaboration. So it's really sad that we lost them so early, but oh, what a score Damn Yankees is. So smart indeed. And I will give Joe credit, Joe DiPietro credit, for dropping Who's Got the Pain, an irrelevant number. George Abbott loved to drag in these irrelevant numbers that take place in some sort of theatrical setting. For example, in Pajama Game, Steam Heat. It's a union rally, you know, to raise money. In Damn Yankees, it was a show to show support for Joe, who's been accused of being Shifty McCoy, who took a bribe. And it was always very clunky the way that he drove in these numbers that really were irrelevant. In fact, Steam Heat is actually a song that Richard Adler did write alone long before he met Jerry Ross, when he was broke and he was in his bathroom, and the radiator just wouldn't stop clanging, and suddenly you hear the rhythm of it. But yeah, really, it's nice that he dropped Who's Got the Pain, because that was really a showcase for the original star, Gwen Verdon. And while Angel Rita could have done it, and could have done it easily, believe me, she really, and boy, at the curtain call, she came out and did a high kick that really defied any type of gravity you have ever seen. So so that was really something too. But, you know, writing for a star, sure, I understand that. But let's have the number be relevant, and Who's Got the Pain just isn't relevant. So so I was very glad that he dropped that. He didn't drop anything else, not that I noticed anyway. Nor was any song added, I'm happy to say. The fact that they made it the Red Sox, there's a streamlining of the book, and he gets a very good joke in that the audience loved, which was the fact that Joe Hardy is now batting 666, you know, so, you know, that's quite clever as well. So, the other thing, there is non-traditional casting in the show, because there's a black ball player, and to the Red Sox shame, they were the last team to integrate, and they did not integrate until 1959. A dozen long years after baseball had its first black player. It's disgraceful to even think that it took till 1947 for baseball to have a black player, but that's the way things were. And so we have to view this as non-traditional casting, because anybody in Boston will tell you the first black ball player was named Pumpsy Green. And ironically enough, there's a musical that deals with this subject to some degree, which I think is very good. We haven't seen it anywhere in the New York area. It was done in Williamstown. It was also done at ART. So it's been done in Massachusetts, because it deals with the Red Sox. Richard Dresser, the playwright who wrote a number of good shows, and also says, when I did the book to Good Vibrations, people called me the next day after the reviews came out and suggested grief counseling. Anyway, but Richard Dresser wrote a very good book for Johnny Baseball, where his theory is the curse against the Red Sox had nothing to do with No Nanette, Babe Ruth, anything like that. It had to do with the fact that they didn't have black ball players for the longest time, and they were being punished for that. So Richard Dresser, and the score is by the Robert Mulli-Reale, the guys who wrote Ear with Frog and Toad. I've seen it, and it's very, very moving. And so there is that baseball musical, too. And that one is less likely, I would think, to come to New York, because it certainly it certainly makes it very clear that the Red Sox triumphed in that 2004 World Series. Now, what's interesting to me here in this version of Damn Yankees that I just saw, the Yanks win. you know, and I think, oh, Joe has an eye to Broadway. You know, he wants to please the New Yorkers who come to the show. You don't bring a musical to New York and have the Red Sox emerge victorious. And that gets a little muddled, I have to admit, too, because, you know, you're really rooting for the Red Sox the whole way, and to find out that they lose the world's the pennant. You know, of course, the point of the show is love is more important than baseball, and I understand that. But you could really feel the palpable disappointment in the crowd, most of the crowd. That's interesting, too. There were some Yankee fans there, and when there was some Yankee banter, talk about the Yankees, you'd occasionally hear, yay, yay, you know, that type of thing. And, you know, really, we're in the middle of Connecticut. I mean, you're just as close to Boston as you are to New York. So as a result, of course, there are going to be some people who have decided to be Yankee fans rather than Red Sox fans. It was really interesting to me, too, in the parking lot, how many cars had license plates with Red Sox imagery, some of them from Massachusetts. Some of them from Connecticut. You can, if you're in Connecticut, you can get a Red Sox license plate. I mean, obviously you pay more for it, but I mean, you can do that. And I really was surprised to see Connecticut license plates with Red Sox logos on them. But there,
Peter,
they were.
You can actually get a New York license plate with a Red Sox logo on it.
the things I'm learning today.
You know,
I had no idea.
I was gonna mention that I have noticed in the last couple of years as the Red Sox have won more games and some World Series too.
Sure.
That there's much less people wearing their Red Sox uniforms and hats in the house and actually wearing them out in public. I see a lot more around Midtown Manhattan. That is very surprising to see Red Sox hats, but you do see them.
I agree. I do too. Yes. And there have been times I've actually considered saying to the person, gee, that's pretty brave. You know what I mean? but yes, I agree with you. I've seen those too. I can't say I've ever seen a New York license plate with Red Sox imagery, but I'll keep looking for that. Of course, my license plate holder, as I may have mentioned in the past, given to me by Karen Plesher, one of my friends and readers, says number one fan, the grass harp. So it does.
I have learned something today. I don't think I've ever heard that before. That's
yeah, it's
great.
Yeah, because I did a column once about the fact that they have all these license plate holders for number one fan, Washington Redskins, number one fan, Boston Celtics. How come they don't have that for Broadway shows? And a few days later in the mail came a license plate holder saying, number one fan, the grass harp. And one time in Trenton, New Jersey, I'm parked. I'm sitting in the car. I'm reading. It's a little early to go to the show. Tap, tap, tap on the window. I roll it down. You love the grass harp? And I thought, all right, this is somebody who's going to be talking about the Truman Capote novel, because that's what it's based on. You know, that's more famous, needless to say, because the grass harp on Broadway only ran a weekend. I said, yes, and I'm about to explain it's a musical. She said, I love that musical. And I was really surprised, you know, because I would expect that very few people know it. Though that score has endured, but that's another story.
It wasn't your classmate from school, was it?
No, it wasn't. Yes. I wonder if it was. I might not have recognized her. Isn't that something? Right. I should have brought up the grasshopper when we were talking. But anyway, we're becoming Facebook friends, you know, so as a result, there'll be a lot of talk about Broadway. So I'll have to ask her, hey, you weren't in Trenton, New Jersey that September afternoon when I checked that out.
So the Goodspeed Opera House playing Damn Yankees through June 21st. They have up on their schedule here, Fiddler on the Roof is next. Irving Berlin's Holiday Inn and the Circus in Winter. So get thee to East Haddam, Connecticut.
Well, the other thing is that Holiday Inn is going to be a new adaptation of that famous movie from the 40s. Since White Christmas has done reasonably well, how long would it take before somebody would say, well, let's do Holiday Inn? Because White Christmas has a real affinity with Holiday Inn. It's almost a remake mm-hmm. in a certain sense. So it's as somebody who worked in hotels, by the way, growing up, the idea of having a hotel that's only open on holidays is a big mistake. I mean, there was somehow, for whatever reason, hotels die on holidays. And you would think that they wouldn't because people would travel and see their relatives. But I guess they do. But I think they stay with them. But in the 3 years that I worked in hotels while working my way through college, I can certainly tell you that holidays were the least populated times in our hotels. So so the idea, that's what Holiday Inn is. It's an inn that's open on holidays. So that's rather strange to me.
So Peter and I, when we get up to East Haddam, we drive. And Michael has mentioned in the past that there is great mass transit ways to get to the Goodspeed Opera House, although they elude me right now. I don't remember what they were, but there are ways to get up there. So if you're a New Yorker and you can't make it up you can't drive up to Goodspeed, you know, there are other ways to get up there. So
what a success story that place is. I mean, really, East Haddam, Connecticut.
Yeah.
Who ever heard of that place? I dare say there were people in Connecticut who hadn't heard of that place mm-hmm. Before it started in the early 60s. That place was packed yesterday, and it was really nice to see. I saw a friend from Rhode Island there who had come, traveled all that distance to get there. He wasn't coming back from anything. He was going there to see the show, and he sees most of them. And I thought that was terrific. And, you know, it must get harder and harder to make that place economically viable. Yeah, I mean, after all, Damn Yankees involves ball players, and that means at least nine of them. And they, I'm sure they had nine guys up there. As I say, one was wearing nine, and I didn't like that, but still, you know, they populated the stage. They did 1776 there a while ago. Good Lord. I mean, you know, I thought, oh, my God, can they even fit the people on the stage? They did. It didn't even look crowded in the worst sense of the word. One of the great success stories in the history of American theater, seriously, is the Goodspeed Opera House.
You know, and going strong.
Going
very, very strong. A few years ago, and I've mentioned this on the broadcast before, is that Goodspeed just built new housing for their actors. I guess it was about 2 years ago or so. When actors from New York or elsewhere go up to East Haddam, they stay there, and Goodspeed provides housing in the area because, as Peter was mentioning, it's kind of in the middle of nowhere, mm-hmm. although it's got great ice cream on Main Street.
And if you think I don't know about that.
Oh, yeah. So they don't have a big Hilton right in town there. Mm-hmm. So they can't house the actors. But they built these houses for the actors. And they are beautiful. And some of the best actor housing I've ever seen.
And by the way, you know, if you get there early and you have nothing to do, which you probably won't, it has a fabulous library up the street of musical theater memorabilia and research materials. And as William Goldman says in The Season about the Drama Bookshop, once you go there, you may never want to leave. Mm. That's very true of that little library, too, which is really quite terrific. And they're so diligent. They'll take anything involved with musical theater. And chances are, if you're doing a research paper or you just want to know something about a show, I'm telling you, that's a very good place to go. It's not very big, but boy, is it packed with stuff. And I frankly don't know if you have to make an appointment or anything like that. But I do point this place out if you want to know about a musical that you can't find anything about. It's a good place to go.
It just occurred to me to ask you this. When Goldman was talking about the Drama Bookshop, you know, the Drama Bookshop is like Madison Square Garden. It's been in multiple places over the years. Mm-hmm. Was he talking about the Drama Bookshop on 7th Avenue that was just upstairs on the second floor? Was that the one that you think?
At the time, it was on 52nd Street. Yes, it did move after that. I think the store you're talking about that was on 7th Avenue upstairs may have been a different company entirely. I'm really not sure about that.
Oh, okay.
I'm starting to think that, no, that was the Drama Bookshop. But the one that he was talking about was on 52nd Street. And that was there for quite some time. And to think that Arthur Seelan started that bookshop with a table in what is now the August Wilson Theater. He went there with the table and started selling books in the lobby, and it led to the Drama Bookshop.
I sort of feel like anybody who is listening to us every week talk about this stuff over the last 5 years, when you get to New York, you don't need to see the best shows, of course, but you also need to stop at the Drama Bookshop on 40th Street. Is it 40th or 41st?
40th, yeah.
40th Street. Just you will walk out, you know, a little bit poorer in the pocket and much richer in the brain.
Well, also, the thing, too, is when you're in there, you know you're in there with people who care about what you care about. I'm not just talking about the staff, but you might run into an actor that you've always admired because they're looking for material, too, either for audition material or they're up for a new play, an established play, and they're buying the script. It's just nice to be in a place that you know that you're dealing with people who have the same affinity you do. So that's fun as well. I like that about it too. You never know who you're going to run into in there. And so that's a lot of fun. And, you know, to find scripts that you, by people you playwrights you may have admired and suddenly they're there, because it's amazing to me what scripts get published. You know, plays that don't have all that much success or even all that much pedigree Or exposure. Suddenly, there they are. The scripts are there, and it's really a lot. Oh yeah, I think you know, given the fact that anybody who comes to New York is going to spend evenings at the theater and matinees at the theater. Well, there's still some time in between or before, you know, that you can get to the Drama Bookshop and still be in the world of theater, even though there's no performance going on at that moment in time.
Although they do have a theater in the Drama Bookshop.
Yes, a little tiny space downstairs. Yeah. I've played that room, I have to admit. You know, so it's a fun experience to see what's going on there on various times. I have seen readings of plays. I've seen lectures. I've been on panels. I've moderated panels down there. So Eleanor Spirit really does a fabulous job of getting books in there. She knows what she's doing. A lovely woman named Nancy does the programming. She's terrific as well. So they care over there. They really do. And you know, and obviously they're not making a fortune. And when you think how many bookstores have disappeared over the last decade or two, the fact that they're still there is both wonderful and miraculous.
Yeah. So a few things that have happened this week before we bow mm-hmm. out for this is it was the announcement of the cast for King Lear at the park. It's to be played at the in Central Park July 22nd through August 17th. And John Lithgow is coming out, and a bunch of other folks as well, and Dan Sullivan is directing. So, Peter, are you looking forward to this one?
Well,
many Lears recently.
I have. I have to admit that King Lear is one play that makes me a little gun shy because I just hate that scene where they tear out the eyes of one of the characters. It's too grisly for me. It's too much of a punishment. And also, it reminds me the difference between one eye and no eyes is a palpable difference. You know, I wish they'd stop at least after one eye. I mean, I know that Titus Andronicus is no laugh-filled comedy either, but this is particularly gruesome to me. But I always go to see King Lear because I love it so much because at the beginning, I remember the first time I read King Lear when I was about 15 years old, and it seemed fairy tale like to me at the beginning when the king is splitting up his kingdom and giving it to the three daughters, and I didn't expect it to go into the direction that it went, and I still remember being that 15 year old boy reading King Lear and being very surprised at the way it turned out. And of course you don't need me to tell you that he's such a fascinating character because he goes from completely denying that his two daughters, well, three for that matter, depending on how your outlook, as he perceives it, you know, are doing him wrong, he's in denial, and then he starts suspecting. And then he becomes sure of it, you know, that journey he takes. And it's a very sad one. So, but there's no denying King Lear is, again, you don't need me to tell you, is a masterpiece. But sitting through that scene, I think I may very well go to the men's room during that scene again and miss it. But still, you know, then, you know, Gloucester does come back. So, you know, what can you do? Sure, you know, and... you know, the experience, we're talking about New York experiences. Please, if you come to New York, even if you have to stand in line, you have to have the experience of being in Central Park at the Delacorte Theater. You know, if it's a nice night, especially, even if it's a brutally hot night, the breezes do come through and it's just a lovely place to be. So don't deny yourself that either.
And we also had word this week that the revival of Titanic, some say has been postponed, but I hear rumors that it's just not going to happen. What do you think?
Oh, I don't think it will either. That's one of those that's going to quietly go away. Certainly there's much to admire in Titanic, no question about it. But I've often wondered how much Titanic in a strange way hurt the reputation of the Broadway musical, because I'm convinced that so many people went to Titanic assuming it was a by-the-book adaptation of the famous movie. and because they both came out around the same time.
Yeah.
And they had to be devastated that there was no Leonardo DiCaprio character or Kate Winslet character, and probably even missed that Celine Dion song. But it is a work of quality. But even after winning the Tony, it certainly wasn't a blockbuster success. It's a very difficult story for a lot of people to watch. You know what's going to happen, and it's nothing good. I think it's a show that's best enjoyed by listening to the original cast album, which is really something. I mean,
yeah.
Mark Esten is one of the best composers we have, and certainly a damn good lyricist too. But he truly has theater music in his soul, and knows how to write a sweeping, gorgeous melody. And the word gorgeous applies to his music perhaps more than anybody else who's writing today. So it's sad, of course, that and certainly the production that a concert version that was done a few months ago got a, you should pardon the expression, Titanic response. I wasn't there, but nevertheless, I from everybody I heard, it was magnificent. So I can understand temptation to do it again. But of course, eight a week is very different from one concert one night. So it's just not enough of a commercial pull for that show to happen.
And talking about commercial pull, do you hear the helicopter blades coming over from London?
What's really nice, I've been occasionally writing for a website called Broadway Direct, and they have asked me to do a few stories here and there, and one of them was dealing with these two parents who had this young girl who was a contestant for the Jimmy Awards. Those are the awards given out to high school students. For the last 5 years, on a summer Monday night, a high school boy and a high school girl who most impressed the judges have received a Jimmy Award named after Jimmy Niederlander and a $10,000 scholarship. And it's not easy to win. And this girl from North Carolina, Eva Maria Noblezada, didn't win. Oh, but she did, because Tara Rubin was in the audience and said, you know, they're doing Miss Saigon in London, and I think you should audition for Kim. So she auditioned and she got the part. And her reviews were very good this week. So, and she, by the way, she, when she was a contestant in the Jimmy, she was a finalist. She didn't win, but she was a finalist. She was a junior in high school. And so she started her senior year, but in January she had to leave to go to London, get set up and start rehearsals and what have you. So she's not quite a high school graduate yet. When Miss Saigon ends, or her role with it, which looks like it's going to be some time now, she'll return to high school and get her degree. But at this point in time, she is not a high school graduate, but what she is in London is a genuine star.
So Saigon opened up in London. Cameron McIntosh announced opening night that Miss Saigon, the new production in London that just opened that night, had recouped its investment on that opening night, which
now,
is...
That's advanced sale, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
Yes.
Isn't that amazing that there should be such interest in this show that would happen? I mean, I don't recall that happening with any of those other mega schools.
The thing is that he really controlled the cost. They opened Miss Saigon for $7.5 million equivalent U.S. dollars there, which is what it cost to open Miss Saigon how many years ago?
It came here in 91. I think it was there in 89.
Yeah, but the U.S. production cost $7.5 million to open this
something?
Year.
Yeah.
And I think that we're going to hear in the... you know, probably after the Tony Awards or something like that, some big, huge announcement that Miss Saigon's going to be opening on Broadway next year.
I wonder if it'll take the Marquee Theater. We hear so many things about the Marquee Theater. Chat had a posting that, it's not going to be a theater anymore. They're going to divide it up and make stores out of it. I doubt it. Musical houses are really in great demand, and I don't think they're going to give that one away. But I wouldn't be surprised, given that place doesn't have a booking at this moment in time if this will be the grand reopening of the Marquee with Miss Saigon. That's my hunch. I haven't heard anything to that effect, but that's my hunch.
I also hear that he wants the Broadway back.
Ah, yeah, well, Cinderella certainly has been there for some time and has done better than a lot of people thought it would. I have to say it's done less impressively than I thought it would. I thought it was going to be a sellout like crazy,
yeah.
That hasn't quite happened, though it's certainly done respectably. And again, I'll go to bat for Douglas Carter Bean's book more than most people will, but because I think a lot of smart decisions were made, and I still urge people who haven't seen Cinderella to go. And I have seen the new cast. So by all means, it is worthy of more than it's produced, but yes, I mean, there's no question its days are numbered, and we may see Miss Saigon return to where it was way back when.
So the last thing I wanted to mention before we wrap up for the day is that it's also Cameron McIntosh in his free time has picked up some new theaters.
Yeah.
Picked up two new theaters, and it renamed one of them the Sondheim.
Isn't that something? You know, I mean, really, when you think of it, and I wonder if he's going to catch some heat for that somebody's going to say, no, a London theater should be named after somebody British. There are so many of our wonderful, wonderful writers, directors, stars, what have you, who deserve to have theaters named after them, who worked in West End for years and years and decades and decades, and you're telling me that you're going to give it to an American whose shows have had, you know, only moderate success there as they've have here. There's I don't think there's been a Sondheim blockbuster over there, has there? I mean, I can't think of one.
Sweeney Todd, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. The Sweeney Todd didn't do well the first time around. Ironically enough, Follies in that 1987 version ran longer than the Broadway production of Follies did. It was something like 644 performances to the 500-odd performances that Follies ran. I imagine there's going to be a lot of criticism of that, and I understand it. You know, I'm delighted that Sondheim has another theater named after him. You're not going to get any quarrel from me about his deserving a theater given what he's done. But I'm only surprised that it would happen in London as well. It reminds me of the time that the Boston Patriots decided that they were going to be called something different from Boston because they weren't in Boston anymore. Frankly, Boston wasn't good to them. Boston refused to build them a stadium, so they said, okay, we're changing our name. And for a while, they became the Bay State Patriots. I mean, that was like a day or two before criticism rained on them so hard that they said, okay, New England Patriots. And I wonder if this is going to happen here. There's going to be so much criticism that Cameron McIntosh relents. I don't suspect so, because he's the type of guy who doesn't want to back down, it would really be indicating he had made a mistake, and I don't think he's up to doing that. And I'm not saying it is a mistake. I'm only saying that if I were a British theater goer, I might be bringing up other people who haven't been so recognized. So we'll see how that plays out.
I wonder why, you know, the Andrew Lloyd Webbers and the Cameron McIntoshes haven't purchased theaters or built theaters here in New York, and maybe they have tried, or maybe it's coming down the road, but I would think that those size producers and those size egos would want their own theaters here in New York to control, you know, what's coming in, and, you know, sort of like what Disney's doing. Disney has total control.
There's never a time when I see Tom Schumacher or Cameron McIntosh that I say, please, will you buy the Hellinger for us?
Yes.
Tom's pretty tired of hearing it from me. I don't see Cameron McIntosh that much, so he's not tired of hearing it from me. I'm sure he's not going to be thrilled to hear it from me the next time I see him. That's the obvious one. You know, and as you say, new theaters. You know, next to the Imperial, if you're looking at the Imperial, you're standing in front of it. Next to the left is a parking lot, and next to that is an empty space. There used to be a theater there. You know, and the fact is, if there's an empty space there now, really, Why was that theater torn down? Way back when. I mean, long before my theater going time, you know, and I've been going for more than a half century. But nevertheless, it's just so sad to see that empty space, knowing that there was once a theater there. Frankly, I don't even know about the dynamics of the theater. It might have been an intimate jewel box of a playhouse that wouldn't even be able to accommodate musicals. I've never done the research to find out. But even, you know, if you look at the logo to the current play, Act One, you'll even see that theater is there. That's included in the drawing. So it's really too bad that I really am pained when I see that little empty space. Though when people say there's no grass in New York, there is there then. There's a little bit of grass there in that space. Do you know what's going in there? Have you heard?
No, I haven't.
It's sort of embarrassing that there should be that empty space on the most famous theater street in New York, 45th Street. It's just too bad that it's almost like, well, how valuable can space be on 45th Street if this is remaining empty? You know, of course, there is the consideration that obviously it's going to be a lot of money to buy that space, you know, and I understand that. But still, it doesn't look good to have that empty lot there in the middle of 45th Street.
All right. So what's coming up for you this week? You have anything special planned?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to a few things that are going to happen this week. I'm finally going to get to that 50 Shades musical. That's not right. I'm going to that other 50 Shades musical. I should put it that way. I'm also looking forward to going to, I've been invited to an event at Westwood High School in New Jersey, because they're the people who did that Anyone Can Whistle I was crazy about. And ironically enough, a few weeks ago at the Theater Night Awards, which are given to only people who are in dramas and comedies, no musicals allowed, I was the MC, and I was asked to give out two prizes, one for Best Director and one for Best Production. And ironically enough, it was by the same guy who had directed this Anyone Can Whistle, both the production, which was Metamorphosis, the Mary Zinnemann show, and Best Director. And I'm thinking, you know, people knew that I was crazy about this Anyone Can Whistle, they're going to think that I opened the envelope and whatever it said, I didn't care, and I gave it to this guy, you know. So, I'm also going all the way up to Rochester to judge their round of the Jimmy Awards. I do that every year, and so I'm looking forward to that. And then Just Jim Dale on Saturday, a title I really take issue with. I understand what they mean is that he's the only performer, but there's still something about it's just Jim Dale. You know, I mean, that's all. So I question the title, but I have a feeling I won't question the show because he's a terrific entertainer. I hope he does something. I don't expect this. I hope he does something from his 1972 musical in London called The Card. I urge everybody who has not got the original cast album, please, the original, not the revival. The revival was a revisal, and it bears no relationship at all. It's a terrible album. But the original cast album of The Card with Millicent Martin, you will question some lyrics about, you know, feminists will really throw up at one of the songs, but it takes place back in the 19th century. And but terrific music by Tony Hatch. He wrote a lot of Petula Clark's hits way back when. And the coincidence is there was a movie of The Card, not a musical, back in, I think, 1950, and Petula Clark was actually in it as a little girl or a teenager or something. But I hope Jim Dale does the song from The Card, because no matter which song he chooses from The Card, it's going to be a good one. It's a quintessentially British musical. There's no surprise it's never played here, but a terrific, terrific score. So I root for that.
Is that at 54 Below?
No, Laura Pell's Theater is.
Oh, it's Laura Pell's?
I think so, yeah. I better find out before Saturday.
Well, I hope that Laura Pell's, it probably won't make it onto YouTube, but if it was a 54 Below, it might make it onto YouTube if he were perhaps to do something special that you don't get to see very often.
Indeed, sure.
All right, so next week, is we are actually 14 days out from that Tony Awards thing, the evening. So next week, we're going to try to put together a Tony Awards prediction show. So look forward to that for the listeners. Michael will be back, and we're trying to get some other folks to give us their quick rundown of
what they think. And let me also say, we're going to be wrong this year, because this year is such a wide-open race.
Oh, my goodness.
It really is. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a Tony Awards where we're so less sure of so many categories. This doesn't necessarily mean that it was an amazing quality year for Broadway. We can debate that. That's a completely different issue. But who's going to win is so up in the air that every one of us is going to get a terrible score in predictions. I can predict that.
That's the prediction to go with.
Right, yeah.
All right. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button for iTunes. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You can listen to us in other ways. One way is a Stitcher app. Which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. And that way we'll get streamed to you automatically. Or listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Rob Diamond and the crew broadcast us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. Also, I haven't mentioned it in a little while, but I'd love it if you can go to iTunes and leave a review for us, because that it'll help others find our show much easier. The more recent the reviews are, and the better that the reviews are for us or for anybody out there, they will be recommended to other listeners who are typing in things like Broadway or theater or something like that. And we will come up higher in those rankings if you leave us a good review. So please do that for us. So on behalf of Michael Portantier, who will be back next week, and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Little shoes, little socks, and each little...